Hello and welcome to Vanguard Audiobooks' The Learning College. I'm Alex Linder. You can find this and everything we record at vnnforum.com and also posted on our new social medium, pyville.net. Today we're going to resume with a middle section of A People That Shall Dwell Alone, Judaism as a Group Evolutionary Strategy with Diaspora Peoples by Kevin MacDonald, the paperback, and we're going to do pages 288 to 309. As I said, that's in the middle of the penultimate chapter, chapter 7, and we've been talking about Judaism as an ecological strategy, the title of the chapter, how they cultivate and try to raise their own genes through a sort of mating and other eugenic practices. They value intelligence, they value learning, etc. So let's dig in. Again, we'll do about the normal length, about 20 pages. Seems to fit. Differences between Jews and Gentiles and psychometric intelligence. Sounds like IQ testing. Given these phenomena, it is expected that Jews will tend to exceed Gentiles in intellectual ability, and particularly in what psychologists term verbal intelligence. Verbal means words, having to do with words. As Levinson, 1958, notes, traditional Jewish education emphasizes verbal knowledge, verbal concept formation, and ability to understand abstract ideas, exactly the abilities tapped by modern measures of verbal intelligence. The belief in the superiority of Jewish intelligence has been a common among Jews and Gentiles alike, has been common. Patai and Patai, P-A-T-A-I, two of them, 89, review data indicating that Jewish intellectual superiority was a common belief among many 19th century and early 20th century scholars, including some for whom the belief in Jewish intellectual superiority had anti-Semitic overtones. Galton and Pearson believed, those are two of the early developers of IQ test, or what led to them, Galton and Pearson believed that Jews had developed into a parasitic race which used its superior intelligence to prey on Gentiles. Francis Galton, a huge, towering intellect, believed that. Castro shows that both scholars and the populace agreed that the Jews of Spain had superior intelligence, and indeed Patai summarizes data suggesting that, during the medieval period in Spain, Jews were overrepresented among outstanding scientists by a factor of 18. Data reviewed in Chapter 5 indicated general Jewish overrepresentation in a wide range of fields in the modern world, including business, science, social science, literature, and the arts. At the pinnacle of achievement, Jewish overrepresentation is particularly striking. Patai and Patai, 89, show that Jews received a highly disproportionate number of Nobel Prizes in all categories from 1901 to 1985, including 11% for literature, 12.7% for chemistry, 20.2% for physics, 35.2% for physiology and medicine, and 26.1% for economics. Moreover, the extent of overrepresentation has increased since World War II, since Jews were awarded twice the number of prizes in the years 1943 to 1972 compared to 1901 to 1930. In Germany, Jews received 10 of 32 Nobel Prizes awarded to German citizens between 1905 and 1931, despite constituting less than 1% of the population during this period. Gordon, 1984. Studies of gifted children are of particular interest because IQs in the gifted range are unlikely to result from environmental influences acting on individuals whose genetic potential is near the population mean. Terman's 1926 classic study found twice as many Jewish gifted children as expected on the basis of their representation in the population, although the true representation of Jews in this group may have been higher because some may have concealed their Jewish identity. These subjects had IQs ranging from 135 to 200, with a mean of 151. One of Terman's Jewish subjects had an IQ of 184 when tested at age 7. His close relatives included a chief rabbi from Moscow, a prominent lawyer, a self-made millionaire, a concert pianist, a writer, and a prominent Polish scientist. His maternal great-grandfather was a rabbi famous for his compilation of a Jewish calendar spanning over 400 years, and the rabbi's descendants, the boy's cousins, had IQs of 156, 150, 130, and 122. Research suggests an average IQ of Ashkenazi Jewish children in the range of 117. In two studies of representative samples of Jewish children, Bachman, 1970, and Vincent, 66, found an IQ average of 117 and 117.8, respectively, although Vincent's results are said to be an underestimate because they excluded a large percentage of an elite group of Jewish children attending fee-paying schools. There is good evidence, says McDonald, that Jewish children's verbal IQ is considerably higher than their performance IQ. And he capitalizes V in verbal IQ and the P in performance IQ. So there's good evidence Jews are smarter verbally than their performance IQ. Brown, 44, found several subtest differences compatible with the hypothesis that Jewish children are higher on verbal abilities, while Scandinavian children are higher on visuospatial abilities. Lesser, Pfeiffer and Clark, 65, found large differences favoring Jewish children over Chinese-American children on verbal ability, but insignificant differences in favor of Chinese-American children on visuospatial abilities. And Bachman, 72, found that Jewish subjects were significantly higher than non-Jewish Caucasians on a measure of verbal knowledge, but were significantly lower on visuospatial reasoning. Large verbal performance IQ differences have been found within Jewish populations. Levinson, 58, studied a representative sample of yeshiva students and found an average verbal IQ of 125.6, an average performance IQ of 105.3, and an average full-scale IQ of 117.86, although he suggests that there may have been a ceiling effect for some students on the verbal portion, whereas in the general population there was a correlation of 0.77 between verbal and performance IQs. Among Jewish children, it was only 0.31. Levinson, in 1960, found that a sample of Jewish boys aged 10 to 13 with an average verbal IQ of 117 had a performance IQ of 98, while Irish and Italian samples matched for full-scale IQ had verbal performance differences of only approximately 5 points, approximately 110-105. So there's a real big split, and they're developing a very specific type of intelligence, much more so than in other populations. Levinson provides evidence that the verbal performance difference for Jewish children increases from preschool to young adulthood. When children were matched on the basis of a full-scale Wechsler IQ, preschool children showed small 3-point difference between performance and verbal IQ, while elementary school age and college student subjects showed a difference of approximately 20 points. Taken together, the data suggest a mean IQ in the 117 range for Ashkenazi Jewish children, that's the majority of Jews are Ashkenazi, with a verbal IQ in the range of 125, and a performance IQ in the average range. These results, if correct, would indicate a difference of almost 2 standard deviations from the Caucasian mean and verbal IQ, exactly the type of intellectual ability that has been the focus of Jewish education and eugenic practices. While precise numerical estimates remain somewhat doubtful, there can be no doubt about the general superiority of Ashkenazi Jewish children on measures of verbal intelligence. See also Patai and Patai, 89. There are important implications of the finding of higher verbal intelligence among Jews. Lynn, 1992, notes that higher socioeconomic status groups tend to have high verbal intelligence, but these groups are not particularly high on visuospatial abilities, you know, your lawyer class, your upper middle class, non-technical. This indicates that verbal intelligence is more important for upward mobility and success in our contemporary societies, and this was undoubtedly the case in traditional stratified societies as well. Wilkin, 83, notes that education and rhetoric was the key to upward mobility in the Greco-Roman world of antiquity, the ability to talk, know words, and understand concepts, convey them to others. In this regard, it is worth mentioning that economic historians have noticed that Jewish economic activity has tended not to be characterized by technological innovation related to mechanical abilities, tapped by tests of visuospatial abilities, the ability to engineer and create things, i.e. performance IQ. Thus, Mossy, 1987, suggests that the distinguishing features of Jewish economic activity in 19th century Germany, remember after they're liberated by Napoleon, they have civil rights, they're out of the ghettos, they're mixing in Europe, and this is one of the differences they found. Mossy says they are to be found, quote, less in outright innovation or invention than in a special aptitude for economic mediation in the forms of the export of German goods or of secondary innovation, technology transfer through the introduction into Germany of processes and methods observed abroad, and new techniques for the stimulation of demand. So they're middlemen, and they're seeing what's out there, and they're gauging it against what exists, and they're noticing new innovations, but they're not really making them themselves, except in the way, in the means of trade more generally. This is a difficult area because a theme of anti-Semitic writing in Germany was that Jews were not innovators, but only appropriated the inventions of others, which is more or less what Mossy is saying. And I think Mossy's a Jew himself. Anti-Semites emphasized that inventors of new technology, such as Rudolf Diesel and Wernher von Siemens, were predominantly Gentile, while several Jewish fortunes in technical areas, such as those of Ludwig Loewe and Emil Rathenau, were made by importing technology that originated elsewhere and were dependent on capitalization provided by Jewish private banks. While among Jews, ownership was divorced from technical competence, the prototypical Gentile entrepreneur was the inventor-artisan, like Henry Ford, whose technical competence was crucial to the success of the company. So Jews arrange the money and the networks, and then they source out the technical competence to non-Jews who are better at it. Whereas in Aryans, they're united in the same person. Again, Henry Ford is the perfect example, but he's also saying Siemens and Diesel are other good examples. Whereas technical competence and inventiveness were crucial to the success of prototypical Gentile firms, among Jews, success was related to having access to capital or to having, quote, commercial flair and the ability to inspire confidence. The origins of Jewish and Gentile entrepreneurs were also different. Mossy, 87, notes that Gentile manufacturers tended to come from the families of artisans whose work is also more likely to involve visuospatial abilities related to performance IQ, whereas Jewish manufacturers tended to come from old trading or banking families. These findings suggest the hypothesis that the Jewish-Gentile difference in economic activity is mediated by differences in intellectual proclivities related to verbal versus performance IQ. Lynn, 87, notes that visuospatial abilities and verbal abilities are actually negatively correlated in populations that are homogeneous for Spearman's G, general intelligence factor, and he provides evidence that there are neurological trade-offs such that the more the cortex is devoted to one set of abilities, the less it can be devoted to the other. So it's kind of a zero-sum game in your brain. You've got to be either performance or visual. Lynn finds that Mongoloids and Caucasian males are relatively high on visuospatial abilities related to mechanical science and metalwork. Lynn's findings build on much older work by Wechsler, 1958, indicating that individuals with high performance IQs are more likely to have mechanical and manipulative ability, for example, carpenters and mechanics, but that individuals with higher level occupations in these areas, e.g. engineers, also have high verbal IQs. These tendencies would make it more likely that Gentile German males would be the type of, quote, inventors artisans whose mechanical ability was a crucial ingredient in the success of their firms. And since verbal IQ is generally related to upward social mobility in modern societies, the data are also consistent with the general finding that Jews were much better able to take advantage of the widespread opportunities opened up by the industrializing economy of Germany. Non-eugenic explanations for Jewish intellectual and achievement differences in Western societies. The attractiveness of the eugenic explanation derives from the following argument. 1. There is a heritable genetic variation for intelligence, e.g. Lynn, 1992. Hundreds of behavioral genetic studies of intelligence confirm this finding, and it is only by rejecting an entire scientific discipline that one can maintain the contrary. So it's absolutely established that genes have something to do with intelligence. Note that the exact level of heritability is not important for the eugenic argument. Responsible estimates of the heritability of intelligence range from approximately 0.4 to 0.8. 1.0 would mean it's completely inherited. But even if heritability is actually lower, the implication is that there is, in fact, some genetic variation for intelligence within human populations. 2. Given the virtual certainty that there is heritable variation for intelligence, then it is certain that the eugenic practices described above would result in natural selection within the Jewish population for the genes associated with intelligence. Nevertheless, the eugenic argument need not deny that there have been other forces that would result in Jewish-Gentile differences. Patai, see also Motulsky, attributes some of the difference to natural selection imposed by Gentiles, what I will term the Gentile selection hypothesis. This hypothesis states that because of the hostile general environment, or hostile Gentile environment, there were strong pressures that favored the resourceful, intelligent, and wealthy members of the Jewish community. One need not deny such a possibility in order to affirm the importance of eugenics. There is indeed evidence that, at times, anti-Semitic actions fell most heavily on the less wealthy individuals who were less able to flee or provide ransom for their families. For example, poor Jews who lacked the means to flee or could not be ransomed by relatives died disproportionately in the violence resulting from the Cossack uprising of 1648. Weinrib, 1972. It is difficult to determine how much weight to give to this hypothesis, however, because wars have affected all populations, and it is reasonable to suppose that intelligence may have been beneficial in escaping the ravages of war wherever it has occurred. For example, Jews have tended not to serve as combatants in military ventures, which undoubtedly resulted in high levels of mortality for common soldiers. Thus, war may well have acted as a similar eugenic selective force among Gentiles. The war kills off the best, leaves the worst, while the Jews stay out and work on their own eugenics and improve. We shall see below that Jewish intelligence appears to be lower in groups deriving from Muslim societies. The hypothesis elaborated below is that the extreme anti-Semitism of the Muslim societies actually prevented the flourishing of a highly literate Jewish culture in which intellectual ability was a key to social and reproductive success, with the result that the average IQ of Jews from these areas is lower than among the Ashkenazim. As a result, when the Ashkenazi Jews began to reestablish ties with their co-religionists in the Muslim world during the 19th century, as Zionism began, the overwhelming picture was that Jews in these countries were much more likely to be uneducated and illiterate. Thus, the proposal that anti-Semitism has been the most important cause of high Jewish intelligence must show that anti-Semitic actions resulting in natural selection for intelligence were stronger in Eastern Europe than in Yemen. A doubtful proposition at best, see below. Rather, high levels of Jewish intelligence and achievement have been associated with European societies where Jews have been given opportunities for developing a highly literate culture in which the educated elite were able to obtain high levels of resources and reproductive success. Moreover, it would appear that some of the severe persecutions, such as the Spanish Inquisition, were directed much more at the successful members of the Jewish community than at the less able, and therefore may not have had disproportionate effects on lower status Jews. After all, it was the wealthy Jews who were often the targets of popular hatred. Also, Jews who continued to practice Judaism in Spain during the 15th century and were subsequently expelled in 1492 were less educated and less economically successful than their converso brothers who remained to endure the wrath of the Inquisition. In this case, the less wealthy Jews certainly suffered fewer casualties and eventually were able to emigrate to North Africa or the Levant. Eventually, the Levantine Sephardim underwent a distinct atrophy of their culture, While the descendants of the conversos continued their highly elite and exclusivist profile on the international economic scene. When these Levantine Sephardim immigrated to the United States in the 20th century, they exhibited much higher rates of illiteracy, alcoholism, prostitution, and wife abandonment than did the Ashkenazim, citing Sakhar, 1992. While the Ashkenazim were quickly upwardly mobile in American society, the Sephardim achieved only, quote, a modest economic foothold, and were more likely to engage in lower status occupations, again, Sakhar, 92. Finally, the Gentile selection hypothesis does not provide a satisfactory explanation of the Jewish-Gentile differences in the patterning of the verbal and performance subscales. These differences are very robust, and the Gentile selection hypothesis must propose that individuals with high verbal rather than performance IQ were better able to escape the effects of persecutions. Now, it might be the case that high verbal intelligence would be more adaptive in escaping persecutions, but it is not obvious why this would be the case. One possibility is that verbal intelligence was associated with wealth and success among Jews, and it was these attributes that were favored during persecutions. However, given the evidence of that wealth and verbal given the evidence that wealth and verbal intelligence were strongly associated because of Jewish religious practices and the occupational profile of Jewish elites in traditional societies, the Gentile selection hypothesis really comes down to a slightly altered version of the eugenic hypothesis. There have also been environmental hypotheses for the Jewish-Gentile difference in intellectual ability. As Levinson, 58, notes, the yeshiva curriculum may well be an environmental influence on verbal intelligence. Very strong environmental pressures for academic success in Ashkenazi Jewish families may also contribute. Although they state that there are no scientific studies measuring the phenomenon, Patai and Patai, 89, sum up a situation that is virtually common knowledge by noting the strong emotional commitment of Jewish parents to stimulating the intellectual development of their children, sending them to the best schools, reinforcing self-perceptions of children as brilliant, and so on. Zborowski and Herzog show that this extreme emphasis on encouraging children's academic pursuits and closely monitoring children's academic performance was characteristic of traditional Eastern European shtetl communities as well. The following quotation from a medieval Ashkenazic source shows the expectation that parents will be highly involved with their children's intellectual and moral socialization. Blog quote, "They will teach him Torah and guide him in the ways of heaven and the precepts and good deeds. They strive and work for his benefit in order that he may be able to study Torah in purity and with ease. They are partners with God, and he gave the child the intellect to grasp the teachings." Quoted in Kanarfogel, 1992. Hertz and Rosen also note that Jewish families highly value the ability to articulate one's thoughts and feelings verbally. Children are encouraged to express opinions and contribute to solving family problems, and they comment on the Jewish mother's role to devote her entire emotional energy to nurturing the intelligence and achievement of her children. The environment in traditional Jewish families in the Eastern European shtetl communities was intensely verbal. Zborowski and Herzog describe a preoccupation with elaborate verbalization, much of it directed at children. Communication is described as incessant. People were even conceptualized as having a total lifetime quota of words, with women having more than men. Silence and a lack of verbal expressiveness were regarded with suspicion. The idea of being private or dignified or silent or inward or completely foreign to Jewish cultural tradition. From a modern behavioral genetic perspective, these pressures need not be seen as pure environmental influences. Plomin and Bergamon, 1991, have shown genetic influence on commonly used instruments measuring home environment. In other words, the number of books in one's home, the amount of verbal interaction between mother and child, social class status, and the commitment of parents to monitoring children's academic progress are not simply aspects of environmental influence on intelligence or other functioning, but also reflect genetic variation among the parents. Intelligent parents have large numbers of books around, talk to their children a great deal, and tend to be in the middle or upper middle class. But their intelligence is influenced by their genetic makeup, and their genetic makeup predisposes them to enjoy reading books and entering occupations calling for high intelligence. Nevertheless, the extreme emphasis on academic accomplishment among Jews may be reasonably viewed as important environmental pressure for high intelligence. An evolutionary perspective is highly compatible with supposing that manipulating environments may be an important component of an evolutionary strategy, citing himself in 1988. Given the fact that humans retain a high level of plasticity, it is quite reasonable to suppose that cultures would develop the intensive methods of socialization necessary to attain evolutionary goals within the particular context in which the group finds itself. In the case of Jews, we have seen that the cultural commitment to education and literacy, as well as the attempt to develop a highly competent elite, can be dated to very, very early in the diaspora. The cultural commitment to education and literacy, and the attempt to develop a highly competent elite. From the present perspective, the development of Jewish education and fostering of parenting practices that result in a high level of intellectual achievement are an important aspect of Judaism as an evolutionary strategy. These environmental pushes toward intelligence can even be seen as complementing a eugenic strategy. From a genetic point of view, these environmental practices would tend to maximize the actually achieved intelligence among Jews by creating a uniform, highly favorable environment. They create a perfect petri dish or matrix for this way of thinking to survive, bring rewards, and thereby justify and ratchet itself ever upward. Within this high-pressure, relatively homogeneous Jewish environment, individual differences are most likely due to genetic variation. This is a general principle of behavioral genetics, says McDonald. As one diminishes the environmental variation, the only remaining source of variation must be genetic. As a result, eugenic marriage practices are assured of being based overwhelmingly on genetic variation rather than environmental variation. As a result, one can be assured that by marrying a relatively intelligent Jew, one is marrying someone with a relatively high genetic potential for intelligence rather than simply one who came from a relatively favorable environment. Between group variation for intelligence among Jews, comparisons between Ashkenazi and Oriental Jews. In addition to studies on Jews in Western societies, several studies are now available that compare Jewish groups within Israel. These studies are important because they call into question the idea that eugenic practices related to intelligence have everywhere been a component of Judaism as an evolutionary strategy. The data will be reviewed, followed by an attempt to place the data within the framework of the present theoretical approach. Israelis originating from Middle Eastern countries where Muslim was the dominant religion are overrepresented among the lower classes in Israel, with high rates of illiteracy among the parents, low levels of formal education, little verbal interaction with their children, fewer toys and other objects that facilitate play, and authoritarian patterns of child rearing. Patai, 1977. Oriental Jews have also been found to have poor performance on measures of intelligence and academic achievement, e.g. Bergen-Belmont, 90, Priel, Amir, and Sharon, Singer, and Weller, 1971. They also differ on personality traits related to academic success, such as being lower on attention span and delay of gratification, but higher on impulsivity. The data on fertility reviewed below indicate that Oriental Jews have higher levels of fertility than do Ashkenazi Jews, although there has been a gradual tendency for convergence within Israel, citing Goldscheider and Shokide. Although Patai, 77, attributes the differences between Oriental and European-derived children to cultural differences based on the differences in socioeconomic status between the groups, Bergen-Belmont, 1990, found differences in verbal, reasoning, and numerical abilities between these groups within social class. Taken together, the data indicate that in comparison to Western Jews, or indeed Caucasians generally, the Oriental group can be viewed as exhibiting a relatively low-investment parenting style, i.e. high fertility combined with low parental involvement. The personality traits of impulsivity, short attention span, and low ability to delay gratification are also compatible with this perspective, since these traits tend to be correlated and are associated with low academic achievement, e.g. Shaywitz and Shaywitz, 1988. At a theoretical level, such individuals can be viewed as biased toward systems underlying attraction or reward, rather than the ability to inhibit behavior and persevere in unpleasurable tasks, citing himself in 1988, McDonald. These results indicate that Judaism has not everywhere been characterized by a similar level of eugenic practices, high investment parenting, and the development of a highly educated entrepreneurial elite. However, eugenic practices appear to have been very common in the areas where Judaism underwent its largest demographic expansions, and thus are central to understanding mainstream Judaism. The data imply that Oriental Jews failed to continue a policy that was well articulated in the Greco-Roman world, and that not only was practiced then, but which has continued among the Ashkenazim and at least some Sephardic groups in the contemporary times. So Jews haven't entirely evenly practiced all these things that lead to high intelligence. It was mostly among the Ashkenazim, and also that's where their population exploded. And it's less among the other subsets of Jews, which are smaller, the Sephardic and the Oriental. But it's still, there were those among those who did practice it, even among the minority Jews. But for the majority, that is what they've done. And the way of doing this, he says, was articulated in Greco-Roman times. So they've known this is how you go about doing it all the way back then, more than 2,000 years ago. Patai, 77, attributes these results to acculturation within a Muslim milieu. Certainly, these patterns do reflect the Muslim surroundings, but it should be noted that Jews have often pursued their cultural practices quite independently from the surrounding environment, and in fact, quote, being different, unquote, is in some sense what Judaism is all about. See chapter 4. Thus, we have noted that the Jewish emphasis on universal education was unique in the ancient world, so that these developments occurred despite the fact that all around them there was relative illiteracy. One also wonders, so the remarkable thing he's saying is not that some Jews were like the majority of all the hominids, it's that Jews developed something that set them apart from the other people. The eugenic practices and the creation of an environment in which a high IQ could flourish, be appreciated, be respected, bring rewards, and be perpetuated. One also wonders why the fact that the great majority of peasants in pre-expulsion Spain or Eastern Europe were relatively unlettered, and that education was fairly uncommon among all classes, did not result in Jews rejecting their emphasis on universal education and the development of a scholarly elite. Moreover, we have seen that the emphases on education, lifelong learning, and the prerogatives of the scholarly elite can be seen quite clearly in the religious texts of Judaism. So that developing and maintaining these institutions was really something of a religious obligation. Their relative absence in the Muslim world is therefore of considerable theoretical interest. There is in fact evidence that Jewish populations in Muslim lands responded rather quickly to opportunities for education and upward mobility. Stillman, 91, shows that the Oriental Jews at the turn of the 20th century benefited greatly from education provided by the Alliance Israelite Universelle, funded by Ashkenazi Jews. This network of schools resulted in the Oriental Jews having, quote, a distinct advantage of opportunity over the largely uneducated Muslim masses. They came to have a new and unparalleled mobility and achieved a place in the economic life of the Muslim world that was far out of proportion to their numbers or their social status in the general population. So Jews network and provide educational opportunities, and the Muslim Jews respond and eclipse the performance of the Muslims. These data indicate that an emphasis on education was highly effective during this period, but they also suggest that there must have been external reasons why this emphasis on education died out in the Muslim world. A hint is provided when Stillman notes that this upward mobility made possible by educational opportunity and sympathetic colonial governments was intensely resisted by native Muslims. The Jews' new status brought about by their European co-religionists often resulted in an exacerbation of anti-Semitism by the native Muslims. See also Lewis, 1984. As described by Lewis, again 84, there was a general decline in Jewish fortunes in Muslim lands from the late Middle Ages to the 20th century. While at the beginning of the 16th century, there is evidence for a highly literate Jewish culture in the Ottoman Empire, this culture gradually disappeared after the 16th century, so that from the mid-18th century until the intervention of the European powers in the 20th century, there was, quote, an unmistakable picture of grinding poverty, ignorance, and insecurity among Jews in the Muslim world. In the earlier period, Jews were prominent as physicians and in trade, commerce, and manufacturing. As in Western Europe, Jews were also deeply involved in finance and tax farming. Interestingly, this flourishing Jewish culture came at a time when Jews formed the ideal intermediary between the alien Ottoman elite and the subject populations, a theme of chapter 5. Jews were favored as intermediaries over Christians because there was no possibility of collusion with the Christian enemies of the Ottoman state. Again, Lewis 84. After this period, there was degeneration of Jewish culture, accompanied by early marriage and a high birth rate, clearly indicative of a shift to a low investment style of parenting. Jews became increasingly degraded in the Ottoman Empire, and their decline was far more extreme than can be explained solely by the economic fortunes of the Ottoman Empire, since it affected them far more than their Muslim and Christian co-residents. There is some evidence that other minorities simply outcompeted Jews in this area, but this was ultimately the result not of deficits in the capabilities of Jews, but of exclusionary practices analogous to Jewish kinship preferences and business ventures that effectively excluded other groups. Thus, the Ottoman Christians were able to take advantage of European education and the preference of European Christians for Ottoman Christian business contacts, thereby overturning the Jewish economic domination over Christians that had been imposed by the Sultan, citing Shaw 91. The increased political influence of Christians resulted in a decline in Jewish influence in the government, and, indeed, discriminatory measures were enacted, and there was an increase in official and unofficial violence directed at Jews. The decline of the Jews was also influenced by increasing Turkish anti-Semitism. As the Turkish regime became more integrated into the society, Jews were less able to play the role of intermediary between the alien rulers and the Muslim and Christian natives, and the result was an increasing strictness of regulations enforcing degradation and humiliation of Jews. As is generally the case in times of economic and political misfortune for Jews, mysticism and Kabbalah, rather than the intricacies of the Talmud, came to dominate religious education. The Zohar of the Kabbalist replaced the Talmud and dominated life automatically and autocratically, without discussion, commentary, or understanding. Kabbalistic symbolism determined all acts of daily life, morality, sexual and hygienic behavior, housing, clothing, food, education, the shape and length of their hair and beards, the furniture used in houses, all that had once been influenced by the Talmud. In the long run, the community became too poor to provide for the education of most children, with the result that the great majority were illiterate, and they pursued occupations requiring only limited intelligence and training. However, with the resurgence of Ottoman Jews in the 19th century, as a result of patronage and protection from European Jews, once again there was a flowering of a highly literate culture, including secular schools based on Western models. In the case of Yemen, the degeneration of Jewish culture was more probably due to anti-Semitic actions by the host society, combined with the fragility of the local economy, which did not allow for the flourishing of the typical Jewish economic specialization related to activities calling for verbal intelligence. Nini, N-I-N-I, 91, shows that in 18th and 19th century Yemen, there was no large urban economy in which a highly educated elite could prosper. The population of Yemen was predominantly rural, and Jews resided in small groups working as artisans forced to adopt, quote, secondary or marginal occupations. Communities were so small that it was often impossible to obtain a quorum for prayer. The persecution of Jews was often intense, and indeed the persecution of Jews in Yemen is generally considered to have been the most extreme in the Muslim world. Because the vast majority of the Jews were artisans, there was no class of wealthy property owners or middle-class entrepreneurs or traders who could support a thriving scholarly community. There was also little need for rabbis because the communities were very small and because Jewish communities were often essentially extended families. The common pattern in other diaspora communities of a wealthy entrepreneurial elite helping the rest of the community occurred only rarely in Yemeni's Jewish history, but when it did, it had the familiar features noted in Chapter 5. Thus, 18th century Rabbi Shalom ben Aharon HaKohen, Iraqi, helped the Jewish community and generally raised the prestige of the Jews. However, his influence was short-lived and he fell due to the envy and hostility of the local Muslim officials. Aroni, 1986. Correspondingly, there were no yeshivot in Yemen of the type described above as typical of Eastern Europe, where scholars competed by debating questions of the law, as is typical in areas with intense anti-Semitism. Intellectual activity tended toward mysticism, and there were frequent outbreaks of messianism. See Chapter 3. Moreover, because of the subsistence level of the economy, the rabbis did not live off public funds and often performed manual labor, so that religious study did not really pay off in terms of being a route to economic and reproductive success. I conclude, says MacDonald, that the pattern of lower verbal intelligence, relatively high fertility, and low investment parenting among Jews living in the Muslim world is linked ultimately to anti-Semitism and, in the case of Yemen, to the lack of economic development. These findings are consistent with the ecological/evolutionary model of parental investment proposed by Belsky, Steinberg, and Draper, 1991. Within this model, adverse, unstable economic situations trigger a low investment reproductive strategy, while economic prosperity and stability trigger a high investment strategy. Although traits related to parental investment also appear to be heritable, the model of Belsky and colleagues is highly compatible with the shifts in parental investment patterns seen among Jewish populations over historical time. Now we got another subsection to close this. High investment parenting is an aspect of Judaism as an evolutionary strategy. So, section on high investment parenting, couple epigraphs. You will see but seldom among them, i.e. Jews, guilty husbands leaving their virtuous partners for abandoned prostitutes or shameless wives abandoning the care of their families and the sacred duties of matrimony and maternity to plunge heedlessly into debauchery. It is there that lovely chastity follows the graces and enhances their charms. There is an amiable blush still overspreads the face of the modest virgin. Tama, 1807, 1971. Page 305 here. We're going to 309 and just a line on there. So, evolutionary accounts of parenting emphasize investment in offspring as a critical variable, e.g. Trivers and Wilson. Parental investment is the cost of reproduction in terms of time, food, defense of offspring, teaching of offspring, etc. In the natural world, there are a variety of conditions which pull for high investment parenting, including stressful physical environments, high levels of predation, and, most important for our purposes, a highly competitive environment. Competition for resources tends to result in animals having fewer and more widely spaced offspring, prolonged parental care, longer lifespan, and lower mortality rates at all stages of the lifespan. In humans, the prototypical high investment pattern is also associated with high intelligence, delay of sexual maturation, stable pair bonding, and high levels of parental involvement with children. Citing a bunch of Jews, Belsky, Steinberg, Draper, MacDonald, and Rushton. The material summarized by Zborowski and Herzog, 52, clearly indicates a high-level style of parenting in traditional Ashkenazi shtetl communities. Jewish mothers in these communities are said to have an unremitting solicitude, direct quote, regarding their children. They engage in, quote, boundless suffering and sacrifice. Parents kill themselves for the sake of their children. The general pattern in traditional Poland was for early marriage, especially for the wealthy, and continued dependence on the wife's family while continuing the boy's education. Hundert, 89, see also Katz, 61. During this period, the son-in-law was expected to distinguish himself in study and attend to nothing else. Bialy, 86, at Keys, 89. The practice of early marriage declined, but the importance of education during the adolescent years continued. Kramer, 89, emphasizes that even older teenagers were still dependent on their parents and not free from parental control and influence. He cites evidence that adulthood began only at age 20. Hyman, 1989, notes that arranged marriages were the rule among Jews until after World War II. Arranged marriages were the rule among Jews until after World War I, since the economic basis of marriage was too important to leave to the vagaries of romantic love. For example, Neumann, 1969, notes that it was common to arrange marriages of daughters around the time of puberty or earlier among both Sephardic and Ashkenazi Jews in all European countries in the Middle Ages. Romantic attraction was, quote, not countenanced in good Jewish society. Despite the lack of romance as the basis of marriage, the high level of family life and commitment to children became a rallying point for those attempting to defend Judaism from the criticisms of Enlightenment intellectuals. Quote, in an age that held up so many aspects of Jewish experience to criticism or ridicule, they could point to traditional Jewish family life as a model of noble domestic behavior and thereby rehabilitate both Judaism and the Jews. Often they trumpeted the superiority of the Jewish family to that of the surrounding population. Hyman, 89. Guttentag and Secord note the following points relevant to the hypothesis that Jews engage in high investment parenting. Long block quote here, 2 points, 3 points. 1. Mortality rate is a theoretically important marker for a high investment reproductive style. Wilson, 75. Peretz and Tamir, 77, summarize data indicating that, quote, almost everywhere, and in all the periods for which statistical data are available, the mortality of the Jews was considerably lower than that of the surrounding populations. This is especially the case for infant mortality. In a survey of 21 countries, Schmelz, 1971, found that the median infant mortality rate for Jews was a little over one-half the rate for the general population. So, twice as many Goyish babies are dying compared to the Jews. This general pattern even holds for Jewish-Gentile comparisons within social class, and there is less of a social class difference in infant mortality among Jews than among other groups. Two, Guttentag and Secord, 1983, show that Talmudic writings emphasize good childcare practices and personal hygiene, temperance, and sexual probity. Hundert suggests that lowered rates of infant mortality brought on by Jewish practices of hygiene, child-rearing, and diet were responsible for the demographic explosion of Jews in pre-industrial Poland. 3. Illegitimacy, premarital conception, and divorce rates tend to be lower among Jews than the surrounding populations. Cohen, Hyman, Goldstein, Guttentag, and Secord find that mortality rates for illegitimate children were actually higher for Jews than for non-Jews, an indication of the normative importance of male parental investment among Jews. Guttentag and Secord also summarize several intriguing sources of data showing that Jewish populations have been characterized by high sex ratios, i.e. the number of males per 100 females. Evolutionary perspectives on variation in sex ratios have emphasized the idea that individuals with high social status should prefer to raise males rather than females because high status males are better able to mate than are low status males. Individuals with low social status are more likely to invest in females since mating is relatively easy for females. The general finding that sex ratio is associated with social class is consistent with this perspective. The sex ratio in higher socioeconomic status families tends to be skewed toward males, citing Boone, Dickeman, Guttentag, and Secord, and Voland. The expectation, then, is that Jewish populations would be characterized by a high sex ratio. The hypothesis that Judaism is a high investment strategy implies that Jewish communities will have high sex ratios, and Guten Tag and Secord summarize evidence that this is indeed the case. First, they summarize data indicating that very high sex ratios among Orthodox Jews, who are presumably most likely to rigidly adhere to Talmudic injunctions regarding the timing of intercourse, see below. Although the data in many cases are admittedly less than ideal, a wide range of independent studies on Eastern European populations indicates high ratios, with the best data set coming from 6 uncorrected Odessa censuses between 1892 and 1903, indicating sex ratios ranging from 109 to 118, although Guten Tag and Secord, 1983, themselves interpret the data as indicating ratios within the range of 135. Moreover, sex ratios ranging from 111 to 115 were found for 3 independent, that is, for every 100 women, there's 100 whatever men, or vice versa. 3 independent North American samples studied between 1950 and 1964, and Harlap, 1979, reports an overall sex ratio of 112 for a large group of Orthodox Jewish women in Israel. Guten Tag and Secord note that the Talmud requires that couples refrain from intercourse while the woman is menstruating and for a 7-day period thereafter. Following this period, they are advised to engage in frequent intercourse, with the result that intercourse is maximalized at approximately the time of ovulation. Although timing intercourse exactly at ovulation would tend to result in a low sex ratio, citing Harlap, James, Zarutsky, Mueller, Magan, and Souls, Harlap found that Orthodox Jews actually tended to resume intercourse 1 or 2 days prior to or after ovulation, resulting in an overall sex ratio of 112. The same pattern was found among wives of rabbis and students of the Talmud who are likely to be the most scrupulous followers of religious law. It should be noted that high sex ratios would tend to result in increased sexual competition among males within the Jewish community, since some males would be unable to find a Jewish mate, because there's more men than women. These males would have to forego marriage or else marry non-Jews, the latter an unlikely prospect, without defection from the Jewish community. This process would therefore have eugenic consequences, since males unable to mate would tend to be from the lower rungs of the Jewish community. And that's where we'll close it today. So, just more evidence that they're doing things that create smarter, wealthier, more curated, as the modern term is, genetic sets that make up the individuals, that make up the body of the species or the race called Jews. I'm Alex Linder. I've been reading to you out of Kevin MacDonald's A People That Shall Dwell Alone, Judaism as a Group Evolutionary Strategy. This has been, I think, the 3rd section of chapter 6, at least the 3rd, and we have maybe 2 more to go, in chapter 7, I mean, the 2nd to last chapter. Anyway, thanks for being with me today, and as always, vnnforum.com, pieville.net are places you can find these recordings as part of our learning college, the stuff you can't get in the accredited system colleges, but the stuff you need to understand what's going on. Join us there. We'll be happy to have you. I'll be back with you again real soon.